Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart, and home of almost, at this point, 1,000 interviews with successful entrepreneurs who've spent, each of them, about an hour with me telling the stories of how they built their companies, their challenges, their successes, and all that, just so you can learn from them, build your own company, and hopefully you'll come back here and do an interview yourself. Today, I've got an entrepreneur who in 2002 founded Majestic Research, and about 8 years later, he sold it for $56 million. His name is Seth Goldstein, and that is one of many companies that he launched and grew, including Sticky Bits, Turntable FM, and his latest, which is called DJs, a new media company focused on electronic dance music and DJ culture. I want to ask him about how he built all those companies, how he raised money for them, how he built a culture, and so much more, and about his new book, The Secret of Raising Money. And I can do all that thanks to my sponsor, Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. I'll tell you later why, if you're a tech entrepreneur, if you're a startup entrepreneur, if you're looking for a lawyer, why you want to get the experience of walkercorporatelaw.com. But for now, I've got to welcome my new guest, Seth. Seth, welcome.
Thank you, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Seth, I held back. There's so much more that you've accomplished, and I wanted to prune the intro so that we can get right into it. But part of the reason why I held back is because I'm worried that people won't identify with you because you've succeeded so much at this point. So maybe you can take me back to a time when you were getting started. Was there ever a period, for example, where you couldn't make payroll, where you were struggling?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a nature of the beast. I think, like a lot of people out there who seem successful on the outside, like I don't always feel successful. I'm driven.
What do you mean you don't feel successful? I'm looking at an Inc. magazine article about you that lists so many successes, including your house, which, and I don't know how they got the value of the house. What was it? 2.6, 5.6, some odd $1 million. The family, the whole thing. What were you going to say? I see that you're rubbing your face like maybe I interrupted you, and I don't want to do that.
So I think what I've been consistent about in the last 20 years. So I graduated college in 92. I lived in New York. I went to Columbia University. I didn't focus on anything that was going to advance me career-wise. I focused on comparative literature and dramatic theory. And I got out of school, and I started my first company when I was 23. That was focused on CD-ROM multimedia. So this was right pre-web. And I didn't know, I was unmanageable, and I am unmanageable, which is one of the challenges that people have with me as a person, as a friend, et cetera. But like I think a lot of entrepreneurs who are listening to this, you know, how do you turn a bug into a feature? And my mom was always entrepreneurial growing up. She ran a international homemakers nanny service outside of Boston.
Okay.
I was beta testing all those different nannies as I was growing up. And she hustled. And I'm going back a little bit, but just to give you a sense of like where I'm coming from.
What kind of hustle? Do you have an example of a time that?
Yeah. That she hustled? So I was a child actor.
Okay.
And that has probably helped me more than anything else along the way in terms of being able to get up in front of a group of people, external investors or members of my team or at a conference, and to be able to communicate my ideas with passion and with confidence and to be able to articulate them and connect with an audience. Mm-hmm. And to channel a certain kind of emotional empathy, right? Or emotional intelligence. You know, my mom used to work the intermissions at the concession stands in Boston where I was doing, you know, middling professional theater. That was her hustle. I mean, she would do all these jobs and she was divorced and it's all I knew. And that's something I've taken with me.
When you say she worked the events, what do you mean?
Literally, she bought 2-liter bottles of Coke at, you know, the supermarket and then poured them in glasses and resold the glasses at, you know, 3x what she paid for the bottle.
I see.
That's her hustle, right? And it was always something. It was always, at times, profoundly embarrassing. But I look back on it now, I'm like, wow. She didn't care what she looked like doing it. It was about, you know, providing me and enabling me to pursue my dreams, which at the time was theater. And I think I've definitely taken that. When I think about my team, it's like the metaphor of the bird and the nest. Like, I go out, and for me, you know, raising capital or getting great talent or getting relationships with other companies is bringing something back to the nest, right? My nest now is I've got, you know, eight developers who are, you know, working away building, you know, an iPhone application and a platform for, you know, creating music together. And I'm out there hustling. You know, I...
What's an example of a hustle that, that you have today, the equivalent of you going out to the supermarket and bringing 2-liter bottles of Coke so you can sell them by the cup?
It's paying for people's salary.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You want to build a culture that is transparent, and you want to build a culture that is empowering, but you also don't want to make people neurotic, and you don't want to make people... you know, worried about where their next paycheck is going to come from. And so it's a very fine balance, I find, where I live with risk, right? I can look at you in the face, you know, when I have a day left of payroll and ask you for, you know, $1 million and be willing to walk away from the table. At least I can tell you I can do that right now, even if I can't. But that's the idea, right, is I have to create an environment internally that allows my team to focus and to relax and to be creative. And we put a huge premium on creativity, on innovation, on invention. I mean, you see how ruthless it is whether you're building an iPhone app or an Android app or a web service or some kind of infrastructure play or now hardware, like all these different types of companies and all the other companies that are right on their heels. And so if you can't create, if you bring the stress of the hustle to your team or to your company, it's just very distracting. And so, and that's what I balance. And so, you know, to go back early in my career, I started my first internet company in 95.
Okay. This is the one that was a CD-ROM business or just after?
Okay, so 93, 94, I started a CD-ROM business, and what did that do for me? It taught me multimedia, taught me how to connect, you know, words and pictures and video.
How'd you get the idea for that business?
So I was working for a very important avant-garde theater and opera director named Robert Wilson, who famously did Einstein on the Beach with Philip Glass in 76, and was part of the New York avant-garde. And I said to myself, so, you know, it's so frustrating because I, seeing all of his archives, it's impossible to communicate the just the art and the beauty of his work in a book with pictures or just in a video. What's magical about him is the way he connects, you know, a picture he sees of, you know, a chair in a newspaper article, and then is able to kind of design that on stage, and then you see that in rehearsal and you see that in performance, and things connect.
Yep.
Over time. And so CD-ROM had just come out. It was the only way I thought of creating an interactive exploration, and it was great. And it wasn't a business per se, but it was an idea and it was a passion. And I felt like it was new and it was different and it was a contribution. And I went to Germany. There's a lot of support for arts and technology there. I came back to New York at the end of 94. And right before the web was really taking off, I was 24. I had no money. I was staying on a friend's sofa. And I joined one company that was agency.com that ended up going public. I got fired after 3 weeks because I was insubordinate, right?
What do you mean? What did you do?
I wanted to meet with the clients. I wanted to talk about ideas, and they just wanted me to program HTML and what were they called? Frames, you know, TD, black, backslash. And I was getting $75 programming HTML.
Okay.
And got fired after 3 weeks. I licked my wounds. I went to another company that had done guidebooks for the internet called NetGuides. Because there was no Yahoo, and the only way of learning about the best travel sites. There was no Yahoo. This was early, you know, late 94, and if you wanted to know the best travel sites, you would buy one of these books and it would have a list of links. And that was an opportunity to meet with Joe Krause and Graham from Architects, which became Excite. Akibono.stanford.edu was Yahoo. So it was really early. My best friend at the time was Scott Heiferman, who's a great entrepreneur who started meetup.com. He had iTraffic. And that community was growing in New York City, like it was out in San Francisco. And I went to go to Condé Nast to work for Epicurious.com, programming HTML. And along the way, as I was going to some of these mixers and meeting and networking in the community, I came across someone who knew the marketing manager of Duracell and said, you know what, Duracell has an interactive agency, Ogilvy and Mather. They weren't really happy with them. They're open to a new interactive agency of record. And so myself, I organized moonlighting a bunch of friends who were designers and programmers, and we built on spec a website for Duracell. I took off work one day from Condé Nast. We pitched Duracell. It went well. I came back, and the next day I was fired because somebody apparently had seen that I had printed out some color copies of a comp that I was bringing to Duracell in Connecticut. And there was about 3 or 4 weeks there where I had been fired. I had no work. I was hoping I was going to get this gig. It was pretty harrowing. We ended up getting the project. We took out of the $240,000 contract, I was able to get, I think, 30 or 40% up front. I bought computers. I incorporated, and that's how I started my first business. Clay Shirky was my CTO at the time, and Clay is a wonderful pundit now. And it was really a glorious era of the late 90s in New York when online advertising could be anything, right? It wasn't reduced to, you know, a banner, a button, a link, and a click-through rate. And I found that liberating. I found the opportunity to invent a new medium really inspiring and something that I believed in. And that company was my first company.
This is called Site Specific?
Site Specific. It was the first, one of the first online advertising companies in New York.
What happened to it?
I sold it in 97 to a public company called CKS Group. I think it was $12 million in cash and stock.
How did your life change after that? I mean, personally.
I had money for the first time.
Okay.
You look at my bank account and be like, wow, that's, you know, and I'd given a lot of the company away, so I didn't, you know, it wasn't like it was all mine. But I hadn't raised really any venture capital. I took some money from a Texas direct marketing company called Hart Hanks. I was the subject of a front page Wall Street Journal cover story about these sort of combating cultures, right? The sort of the new upstart, you know, Seth Goldstein's 26 and he books his own travel. You know, Larry Franken, the CEO of Hart Hanks, is 56 and doesn't know the difference between Java and a cup of coffee. It's one of those articles about old versus new, which to this day I still relish. Not that article, but this idea that we do have to invent new ways of creating companies and of connecting with employees and of raising capital to support it.
Your next stop was to be an entrepreneur in residence at Flatiron Partners, Fred Wilson's previous venture fund, right?
Yeah. Between those two, you know, successes are the, you know, inevitable failures that I don't talk about as much.
What are they?
I started a company. This is why it's dangerous sometimes to back an entrepreneur's company after they're successful, which is they think their shit doesn't smell, right? So I made some money and I spent almost half of it with another startup called Root.net that was TaskRabbit meets an online travel agent circa 1997.
Okay.
And the idea was to give people a single stop for managing all their online travel, e-commerce, calendaring, et cetera, needs. This is the era of the Palm Pilot. I funded it entirely myself. And when someone didn't agree with me, I said, fuck them. I know what I'm doing. I'll show you. And at a certain point, I was like, you know what? I might as well take the tax loss from my previous gain and shut this down and just claim all that as a loss. And I shut that down.
When you take a tax loss, it means what? That you can get back some of the taxes that you paid on in the past because you've lost money now.
Yeah, it was sort of the same, I'm trying to remember, the same tax year of when I got the gains from my previous sale. And so I could use some losses to offset that. Anyway, it was a elegant way of accepting defeat and moving on.
I'm looking at a screenshot of what that site looked like. Root.net is a new membership service for busy, connected professionals. Our goal is to save you time by integrating great services with convenient methods of access. Why didn't it work? It seems to make so much sense, especially since we now know that variations of this have worked out.
So it was literally 15 years ago, right? It was a long time ago.
1998. It says from July 15th, 1998. You continue from there.
It didn't scale. The systems weren't in place to really enable the kind of frictionless mobile commerce and connectivity. All we had were these Palm Pilots, you know, and they weren't really wireless. And it was the right idea. It was just early. Okay. My hope is as I've gotten older, I've gotten slower, and my ideas won't be quite as far ahead as they've been in the past.
I see. Okay. And so because it wasn't connected online, you couldn't really request a service. Was it that you had to plug it into your computer before it can take the action that you wanted to take?
Well, I think it was actually even simpler, which was, you know, the model was, and it's, I think you take for granted these services work and they make sense, and you have executive assistants online, and you have all sorts of things you can outsource to the cloud and to third parties through APIs. For the time, this was literally, we had a Root rep, we had a customer service rep in the office in New York, you know, wired up with a headset at his computer, and then we had a, it was kind of like the Truman Show. There's a great Business Week article that I can share with you, you can find it, about sort of this trial where we had five people who were following this one guy wherever he was, and when he wanted flowers for his wife, he wanted to book a trip somewhere, he wanted to find the laptop that he left behind in the hotel room, we were there at his beck and call.
I see.
We were going to charge $100 or $200 a month for subscription. And, you know, with unlimited capital, it probably would have worked. You know, but at the time, it was very labor-intensive. One funny tidbit is if you, are you a fan of Wes Anderson movies?
Yeah, I love them.
You know, Waris, Ahluwalia, is the Indian Sikh who's always, you know, he's filming Zizou, right? He's the Indian dude in a lot of them. He was our original Root rep. He's my brother's best friend. And he, more than anybody, went on to bigger and better things. So, but I learned from it. It was painful, but I was able to kind of move from there. And then, you know, Fred and Jerry Colonna were really the only two internet-focused VCs in New York at the time. And there, you know, it was at the beginning of this crazy explosion of hype and paper wealth, and for some real wealth, for other people fake wealth, from 1998 through 2001. And I had a front row seat as an entrepreneur in residence, and ultimately as an investment principal, you know, during that time, where I started companies. I probably put also probably $100 million to work across a series of other companies. The firm
made
a lot of money.
Within Flatirons, you were investing.
Flatiron Partners, which was a subset of Chase Capital Partners.
Okay.
So Flatiron was, in a way, funded by Chase and SoftBank. Flatiron's first deal, one of the first deals, was GeoCities. And so GeoCities, you know, they put in, I want to say, $5 million, and Flatiron ended up with $300 in the span of a year or two when GeoCities went public and ultimately got sold. And, you know, I was 28, 29 years old, just married, just had a kid. I was like, wow, this is awesome. I'm a great VC. I love this. I'm getting checks about deals I had nothing to do with. And it was a very heady time. And then it became a miserable time. And when the capital markets shut in mid-2000, you know, a lot of these companies that I had worked really hard on, that had done really well in terms of hitting their milestones, couldn't for the life of them continue because the capital markets had turned its eye and nobody wanted to fund this internet dream anymore.
Seth, Jerry Colonna, talks today about the monster in your head, that internal doubt, that internal critic that entrepreneurs especially face. At that period where everything was just falling down around you, we're talking about the early 2000s, did you have a monster in your head?
Lots of monsters.
So what is that like for you? I want to understand what it's like for an entrepreneur who's had success when that goes crazy. Is it images in your head? Is it voices? Is it regrets?
It's a deep question. So, let me
take some time with it.
I'd like to say that my job as a founding CEO mm-hmm. is to be a kind of shock absorber. And when things are too good, maybe it's the neurotic Jew in me, like, wait a minute, something bad's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And if things are horrible, I need to make light of it. And I do think that's part of what I do, and I think that's part of what any entrepreneur does, is to provide that kind of ligament in an organization. Mm-hmm. So all that being said, 1999 to 2000 was such an anomaly, right? Never in our life are we going to experience that craziness. And people may talk today about a bubble. You have no fucking idea. Like that, that was a bubble, right? But because it was a bubble, and a very successful bubble, meant that you didn't realize you were inside of it. Now I look back, Cosmo was one of the deals I did. I was very proud of Cosmo.com. And Cosmo was, anything you want under an hour.
Delivered for free, including a candy bar. No delivery fee, but there was the cost of the candy bar.
True. I didn't think of it as a free candy bar, but one of the issues is people would order a Coca-Cola, and that would be it.
I used to do that. I would order Ben & Jerry's just because I felt like Ben & Jerry's, or order a DVD because I just felt like watching a movie. Yeah.
Which is exactly the idea, and the business worked really, really well. It was scaling like crazy. It was a great set of entrepreneurs, started in New York and San Francisco and Boston, and I'll never forget, I got the deal. I got them to take, $12 million of our money at 50 pre. I was a boss. That was awesome. I was showing myself as a great VC because I convinced them to take my money at that price. Mm-hmm. And that was the mentality. It was a very hot deal. It could have been the next Uber. It was a kind of logistics platform. It wasn't a Korean grocery store online. It was, I went there and I saw, wow, someone orders online, the thing comes out of the printer, somebody else takes that slip of paper, they go to the freezer, they get your Ben & Jerry's, they go to the DVD player, they go to the DVD rack, they get the DVD, they give it to some guy on a motorcycle, a little orange moped, and boom, there you go, within an hour. To get the deal done, we had to get approval from Chase Capital Partners. And so every Monday morning, eight of us at Flatiron would talk about the deals, and then every Monday afternoon at lunch, we would we go from 21st Street and Park up to 45th and Park to the Chase Capital Partners, office building. There'd be 100 people in this conference room. And I thought, okay, here's what I'm going to do. To really grease this and make sure there's no issues, before I left Flatiron that day with all eight of us, I ordered a dozen pints of Ben & Jerry's to be delivered to Chase right around the time lunch was over. And sure enough, people went through their deals. It was our turn. We went through a couple of deals. And right before I got up with Fred to kind of talk about Cosmo, this Cosmo delivery guy shows up on cue, a dozen ice creams, and of course you get your deal approved, right? And everybody loved it.
Yep.
And then I remember sitting with my one-year-old. I'm getting very anecdotal on you. I'm sitting with my one-year-old in the car. I'm having a call with the bankers. I'm listening in with Cosmo, Amazon, Starbucks, Kleiner, SoftBank. They just put money in at 900 pre, right? It was $100 million. I remember going to DLJ, which was one of the banks, the internet banks. Jamie Keegan was the internet analyst. I remember sitting down with him and him telling us, okay, when you go, and this was probably February of 2000, late February, when you go public, here's how it's going to trade. You probably start out at a $4 billion market cap. It might trade up a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that was the world. And then suddenly it was over. Just, and it wasn't over in one fell swoop, but, you know, that IPO got pushed a week and then a week. And then everything else started getting pushed. And pretty soon you started grasping at straws and there was no certainty. And then the doubt came in. And it got really negative. And then, you know, my job went from being the, you know, the idea kid, finding trends and throwing money at them to, oh, wait a minute, like, I got to wind these companies down. I got to go in and look at these entrepreneurs who've done everything they said they were going to do and tell them there's no more money and get them to lay off half their staff or fire them. And, it left a pretty nasty taste. It was very healthy for me to know that this is a cycle. You can't take any of this stuff too seriously. And that, you know, you it's very easy to confuse luck with skill. And I thought I was a great VC early on. And then I felt horrible that I was such a bad VC. But the reality is the macro environment was much bigger than I was. Mm-hmm. But it's still clearly a formative experience for me and something that, I think informs the way I look at investments and the way I look at opportunities.
So how do you bounce back from that when it's not just trying to get your head back on, but also unwind everyone else and deal with them and face an environment that's really stacked against you, which is what it was in the early 2000s? How do you, with all that against you, get back in the game?
I mean, well, I don't know what the broader lesson is. I know what I did.
What did you do?
You know, I went catatonic for a while. I think everybody deals with stress and depression, macro depression and financial hardships, I mean, differently.
Does that literally mean staying at home, staying in bed, watching TV? Is that what you mean by catatonic?
I think there are moments of that. I mean, I think when your identity gets wrapped into
yes,
this thing and this world and this momentum and then it's gone, it's a really empty place because you built your identity. And some people, you know, had some, you know, I think there were some really scary stories about entrepreneurs and about investors that had bought into it hook, line, and sinker. And it was a very complicated time, and you see what people were made of. I mean, for me, I thought about, I applied to business school. I've always felt more in the past, you know, insecure about not having a proper finance background, not understanding economics properly. You know, I wanted a business school education beyond just networking. I feel like I know a lot of people, but I like school and I like studying. I like, you know, theory. So I made my application to Columbia. At the same time, one of the companies that Flatiron had funded was a company called ComScore. ComScore is now a very large measurement, publicly traded company. It's ironic, the CEO or chairman of ComScore just came in as an angel investor in DJs last week. ComScore was a Flatiron deal. And I learned in 2001 that there was some really interesting data at ComScore about that potentially correlated with revenue of publicly traded companies like Amazon.
Okay.
Right? If you saw a million people, what they were doing online, you could extrapolate as to how Amazon was doing. And in a world where regulation and fair disclosure rules and companies can't say anything during the quarter, what I realized in New York is, you know, when in Rome, right? Like New York's good for a couple key verticals, you know, media and advertising, finance, et cetera. Mm-hmm. All these hedge funds. And hedge funds were the one guys who were making money while everything else was going to shit because they could bet on things going down. Mm-hmm. And so as the internet market and the startup market imploded in 2000, 2001, you saw the sort of corresponding explosion of hedge funds, 2002, 2003, 4, 5. And being a good entrepreneur, I said, that's interesting. That's growing. Can I, what's the Woody Allen movie? Can I Zelig myself into that? Right? Put on a suit, and I started, I found a great co-founder, who came out of Carnegie Mellon, computational finance, and I had this idea, well, what if I were able to take ComScore data and package it as research for hedge funds?
Mm-hmm.
And I was at the same time contemplating going to business school, and my son was 1 or 2 years old. I lived on the Upper West Side. An incredibly supportive wife who was working. I went on a couple of those early customer calls, I guess as they're called, and people bought it. And I walked into a hedge fund and said, hey, I've got some data. I think it can indicate, and they're like, I'll take it, because they'll take anything once. And I had enough different funds agree to spend $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month. I was like, okay, well, I got into Columbia Business School. You know, I'm 30, whatever. I'm 31 years old, 32 years old. If I don't go now, I'm probably not going to go. I've got this opportunity to run another startup. It looks great now, but who knows what's going to happen. I chose the startup. I raised a little bit of angel money, and that became Majestic Research. It was named after the building I lived in. And that was how I pivoted myself from online advertising to Wall Street Research, which would seem to have nothing to do with each other. But it makes total sense when I think about it now.
When you describe it now, it makes total sense. But I was in here with my researcher in preparation for our conversation. I said, what happened here? Maybe he's much more of a finance guy, and we didn't recognize it before because he packages finance understanding as software companies, as internet companies. And then is that what became Root Markets?
No, it was different. So what I learned in the case of Majestic is there's so much noise out there, right? And, you know, there's a sort of ritual where, you know, a public market investor will listen to the earnings report of a company, and the analyst will listen to the earnings, and they'll all just talk about the same things. They all have a spreadsheet with, you know, 500 fields of data, and 499 of them are commodities.
Mm-hmm.
But what if I could provide that one cell of information that was unique or proprietary?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to do everything else, right? And, you know, these funds, more and more, you know, they have huge positions. So a fund like Lone Pine or Tudor or Maverick or Ziff, they'll have, you know, they had $300 million position in eBay. At the time, nobody on Wall Street knew how to do something that's probably pretty basic now, which is to count all the transactions worldwide for eBay listings. You can write a bot or a spider to do that, right?
Yep.
Nobody was doing that on Wall Street. Well, okay, I got a programmer. We did that. We packaged that up, and that's research, and that's valuable.
I see, yeah.
And so I think what that's done for me over time is to just, you know, I had a similar conversation with my team at DJ's a couple weeks ago. We were working on a new feature that was a more of a radio kind of lean back experience. And they were doing it in a way where there was nothing really proprietary about what we were doing. It was something that anybody else could do. I was like, wait a minute, like, let's only focus, we're eight people, let's only focus our energies on something that we can do uniquely well.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think that's definitely a through line for any successful business is in the world of lean startups. It's great so long as you're working on something that's differentiated.
And so you couldn't do that. And so maybe that explains why when I play music on DJs, it's SoundCloud that's serving up the music, right?
Yeah. So forget DJs.
Uh-huh.
Focus on Crossfader, the app. And if you go to crossfader.fm, you'll see what DJs is becoming, which is we're moving from a top-down kind of media site focusing on professional DJs,
mm-hmm.
and big-name DJs to becoming what I think of as sort of an Instagram for music. It's a creative community for people to create and share their own electronic music.
That's
coming out of the app. And if you go to crossfader.fm now, you'll see that's what getting surfaced are people's favorite crosses.
Crossfader. Okay. So now I understand how you got into research and the connection to what you did before. The next thing I wonder is music. Anne Marie here was in the office. She was looking up all these articles about Turntable FM and and also DJs. And what she kept saying is a lot of these articles say, and by the way, no one's ever made money in music. She said, we have to ask Seth then, with all the things stacked against you when you're going into music, back even at Turntable FM, the record industry told you you can't allow people outside the US to play their music, and suddenly you had to lose a lot of traffic. So with all that against you, why go into music?
You know, you get an idea, or you get, my ideas are always more powerful than any rational thought, right? Like, I get so connected to a vision and to a reality that I think is inevitable, that I just can't imagine doing anything else. And I think the case with moving into music, first of all, I learned a lot from Majestic in terms of understanding how public market investors work. Mm-hmm. And I think for any startup entrepreneur, it's a great lesson to understand how the public market, how the hedge fund, how T. Rowe Price, how Fidelity thinks about the stock market trickles down to your startup. And even if you're two people or three people raising $50,000 or $500,000, knowing, at what point did, T. Rowe come into Twitter? And which hedge fund just bought a big slug of Uber? TPG did, right? So these are names that probably don't matter to a lot of young entrepreneurs, but it just gives you a sense of the food chain. And you realize that, on some level, there are notable exceptions like Google and Facebook who have managed to kind of write their own rules, but it's the exception, not the rule. That it's this dance towards the public markets and being looked at in a certain way with certain growth expectations, right?
So how do these big financial institutions play into someone's decision to back DJs or not? Can you make it more concrete so I can understand it? I've never heard anyone, well, at least not on Mixergy, talk about it this way. Or maybe you want to talk about another company.
I apologize if this is going to seem a little schizoid, but I think there's a connection here. Mm-hmm. So Yahoo buys Tumblr, right? Mm-hmm. Does Tumblr have any revenue?
No, not really.
Okay. Facebook buys Instagram.
Zero.
Google buys YouTube, right? None of them really had any revenue. Mm-hmm. And yet the acquirer's stock price really went up, mm-hmm, over time, right? You can look now and say, thank God Facebook bought Instagram, because if it didn't, that mobile story would suck for Facebook, right? The jury's out on Yahoo and Tumblr. But the point is, like, clearly the investors in Yahoo, right? Mm-hmm. And the investors in the investors in Yahoo, right? They need something to feel good about their investment. They need a certain kind of growth, right? If you look at what happened with Twitter, the stock got clobbered a couple weeks ago or 2 weeks ago, lost probably 25% of its value, because the revenue was great. They beat expectations, but the growth was slowing. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we are in what have you done for me lately world. Silicon Valley is all about growth. It's get big fast, grow or die, whatever you call it. It's different depending on if you're an enterprise or you're in different kinds of markets. I don't want to make a blanket statement, but there's this need to keep growing at the expense of others, right? I want more users, and I want my users to be spending more time with me. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to worry about sticking ads in their face yet. If I charge for that app, I'm going to have fewer users. I better not charge for that app. And so this just happens, and you'd think, well, it's going to go out of fashion, but it goes back to the beginning of the internet. There's always a premium on one's ability to grow and engage an audience. And whether that's Reddit, whether that's Tumblr, whether that's Snapchat, whether that's Secret. You know, we see these phenomena happening where there's a seemingly organic community that is engaging a younger audience, and they're spending more and more of their time there, and that flows all the way up the food chain from the first money they get from first round capital or from AngelList, you know, all the way through the secondary 6 months after they've gone public or they've been acquired. And that's what I think about. And now you talk about music. Well, you know, there's a part of me as an entrepreneur that just loves the challenge of people saying, "Oh, I don't do music deals." I'm like, fuck you, you will after this is done, right? I love that challenge, right? I love to prove somebody wrong. I mean, I think that's what a lot of entrepreneurs have on their shoulder. But I make it hard on myself. You know, I have, you know, the people that I know that have made, by and large, the most money are not necessarily those that start their own companies and sell them. It's those that, you know, go into a company as employee number 20 in biz dev and ride that through an IPO and walk away with $30, $50, $100 million, right? They're not taking the same kind of risk, but they're very calculated about kind of how they optimize their own earning potential. Like, I don't think that way. I don't think a lot of entrepreneurs think that way. I love building a brand. I love creating something that doesn't exist. Or it hasn't existed. I love getting people to rally around a kind of a vision for the future. I'm going to get back to the music, making money in music. But just to give you an example of what really turns me on is for Crossfader, we enable people to grab two loops and mix them together on their iPhone just by moving the iPhone. Mm-hmm. And it's beautifully simple. It radically simplifies electronic music, right? You know, you can blog really easily using Tumblr. You can make digital photographs and share them using Instagram. But if you want to make music, it's still really hard. Now we're trying to make it easier.
And your co-author showed me an early version of the software. He showed it actually here. He was at Scotch Night at the office, and he showed it off, and everyone was able to instantly grasp it. And it wasn't until they touched it, though, that they got it. He had to put his phone in their hands, and then they fully got it. Because it doesn't seem like it's going to be easy until you see it. By the way, you said you want to really show them that they are wrong. Fuck you, I got it. Is this the same attitude that you had at Root, which you earlier in the interview said, I regret walking in and feeling like I was right, even when everything around me said no? Or is there something different here today?
I think I think I can answer that obliquely by this.
Yep.
By what I experienced last week. A year ago, I had who's now our product manager, write sort of a vision piece of, you know, what is a remix community? And we were just DJZ.com, and there was a top down website. And I said, look, you know, if we release Crossfader and X and Y and Z happens, and then we build this on top, like, we're going to have this world where people are going to be remixing each other's stuff, right? Yep. We're in a mashup world already. People mash up images, they mash up text, and they add captions, and it's just the world we live in. People's attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. We used to listen to albums. Now we only listen to songs. I think in the future, our kids are going to listen to loops, right? And I said, I want you to write a kind of a narrative of this fictional remix community. And in it, he talks about this hypothetical kid in Wisconsin. He comes across this app, and next thing he knows, he's getting popular. He's not just a nerd anymore. And he mixes Harlem Shake and The Cure, Boys Don't Cry. And so it's about a page or two. And a couple weeks ago, I saw where we were, and we're hustling to get ready for South by Southwest with a very big release 3.0. And it dawned on me that we were there, that we put our heads down for a year, and I recirculated this note that he had written, and I uploaded, you know, Boys Don't Cry so we could all mix it together with Harlem Shake. And And that made me so happy, right? And that, what it didn't make me happy because I proved something. It made me happy because I think I was able to give my team the confidence to trust their imagination.
I see.
And to be able to realize that, like, we can invent things that seem fictional now, but we can achieve, right? And that's the most powerful thing that I can do as leader of the company is to endow people with that confidence that, you know, together we can set, you know, we can imagine something, we can set the course, and then we can achieve it. Now, going back to music, music is tricky, but it's fascinating. I mean, people listen to more music than ever. Unlike video, you know, if you're on the video, like, and I'm paying attention to you, like, that's the only thing I can do, right? And the minute I start checking Gmail or I start looking at tech meme or whatever I do day to day, you'll feel that. Mm-hmm. Whereas if there's music coming, it is more ambient, mm-hmm. right? And I think that has, you know, music has become a something we bring our soundtrack with us, right? I walk into my house, I turn on, you know, Sonos, and I listen to songs. You know, I leave my house. If I have a cleaning woman coming once a week, I actually make sure to leave a Songza station on for her to listen to. I'm in my car, I'm on my, you know, iPhone. It's totally everywhere. And yet there are these rights holders that own the content. And it's changing. And you have SoundCloud, and you have Spotify, and you have streaming, you have downloading, and you have all the mobile experiences. And there's so much usage. People love music. It's so emotional. And I realized that from Turntable. I haven't figured out yet how to make it a $1 billion business. I have a couple of I think, are pretty powerful ideas. I don't want to just simply distribute music differently. I want to change the way people experience it. And I think that's possible. And I think, in a way, because music has such a bad name, it's scaring away a lot of competition. And so it's just a much more opportune, right place to innovate. It's also easier to get great talent because they're passionate about it as well. And
there are two other things I want to ask you about before we end. I want to talk about the book.
Yeah, we haven't talked about raising money, but I guess we have.
Yeah, and I also want to ask you, if we have time, a little bit about culture and the way that you get the people who you're working with inspired. But first, I have to thank, as I said at the top of the interview, Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. This is the period where I should be doing a commercial for Scott. Instead, what I'll do is just ask you, Seth, do you have any advice for an entrepreneur who is looking for a lawyer? You don't have to say go to Scott. I'm just thinking, any advice if you're looking for a lawyer from someone who's done it a few times?
Yeah, it's. I don't think it's about the firm. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, it's not about the. You can get the documents you need, you know, from seed finance documents. You can get the convertible notes you need. You can incorporate very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. But the lawyer, to me, is the person that's there between the cracks to help you deal with things that you don't anticipate.
You mean legal issues or also other advice that you need as an entrepreneur?
I think a lawyer helps you find points of leverage, right? It's lonely being a CEO. You know, there are inevitable legal issues that you have to deal with. But a good lawyer is like a consigliere. And there are times when, you know, you don't want to talk to your investors about something. You don't want to talk to your employees about something. You need somebody to talk to mm-hmm. that you can trust. Having that privileged relationship, I think, is very helpful. You know, well worth it.
All right. And if you out there are looking for a lawyer and you want to see if you've got this kind of connection with Scott, I'll give you his email address, which is Scott Scott@WalkerCorporateLaw.com. Scott@WalkerCorporateLaw.com. And if you're looking for a lawyer, he's the person who basically will be there for you when you're looking to raise money, when you're looking to sell your company. But the relationship doesn't start the day that you're doing either of those two. It starts earlier on. So if you're someone just getting started with a company, looking for a lawyer, or early stage looking for a lawyer, hit him up, send him an email, find out how he can help you get going, and then get a sense of him so that you see if he's someone that you can work with long term. WalkerCorporateLaw.com. I hold up his mug for a reason, to keep reminding you guys.
The other thing the lawyers do is they'll give you a sense of best practices.
Because they see
example,
so many.
If you want to know, like, hey, how much of how big of an option pool do I need to leave, or do I really, do I really have to give this investor, their pro rata in the next round? I mean, a lawyer will say, "Hey, I've done X deals, and this is what's market," or you know what, maybe you shouldn't give, this amount to, you don't have to give a board observer right if you don't need to, right? So lawyers are really good at helping you understand kind of what the market rate is, as it were.
Speaking of that, the book isn't fully released yet, but I've got a couple of chapters through Michael, your co-author, and one of the things that I like about it is you've gone through this process from so many different angles, helping to find entrepreneurs to invest in and making those decisions, to being on the other side of the table where you're trying to raise money. So you have the credibility, you have the experience, you have the knowledge, but you also don't just give me big ideas. You give me specific tactics. Like if I'm trying to raise $2 million, I might want to tell people I'm raising $1 million. Why? And
fundraising is about creating deal heat, mm-hmm. and about getting investors to respond to you on your time frame, and getting them to chase you. And the basic psychological tools that we have, like, perceived scarcity, right? Very, very important. And all the psychological jiu-jitsu moves, again, I think I take them for granted, but I think working with Michael, he's sort of been able to sort of isolate them and say, hey, yes, you know what? If you're looking for X, say you're only looking for half of X, because then it's going to make it feel like you're oversubscribed, mm-hmm. right? Some of these things can bite you, but Michael and I will do things like I'll get someone to say, yeah, they're in, they want to invest, and rather than me following up with them, I'll have him. In the past, I've had him send them a note saying, hey, I heard you had a great, meeting. Here are the investment documents, here's our bank wire information. And then he can also follow up and say a couple days later, hey, can you give me that confirmation of the wire? I haven't seen it hit our account yet. I'm just checking. Like, those are little things, but you need to know this stuff. Like, because it's not about getting someone interested in your deal. You got to get the money in the fucking bank.
And what's the difference if he follows up versus you following up? It looks more desperate if it comes from you, and much more transactional if it comes from him.
I have more important things to do, like talk to you on this interview.
I see.
No. It just subtly, it's like the wingman, mm-hmm. in the rules or whatever, like, dating or any of these sort of being chased versus chasing. Like, I knew with Turntable, for example, we grew so fast that summer of 2011, went from 0 to 500,000 users in the span of 2 months. It's like, wow, I've got the tiger by the tail. It's time to raise some capital. And I tried to really condense that window to the point where there was one day I did 5 meetings on Sand Hill Road, and I ended each one of them 15 minutes early and ran out. Literally to the point where the investors, wait a minute, right? Because you want the investors to chase you, because we spend all of our time being interesting to death. Oh, that's interesting. Let me get back to you. Let me talk to my partners and circle back to you. That's really interesting. And we get nowhere. And so the whole challenge here, and what we're trying to do with the book, is turn around a little bit. You can't fake it, but investors are investing, they write off tons of investments that aren't the next Facebook, even though all they're talking about is they're winners. And I think everybody should have the opportunity to raise money to build their vision. And it doesn't mean you'll always do it, but you should have the wherewithal to do so if you've got the gut, you know, and you've got the instinct and you've got the hustle in you and you've got the basic ingredients of being a good entrepreneur.
And that is, from what I can see from the little bit that I've gotten to read ahead of the release of it, that's what this book is about. It's those kind of tactics, that kind of approach to raising money.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, investors, they don't want to admit the fact that they're lemmings, just like everybody is in some capacity. And they will have all the criteria of what they look for and what they don't look for and the themes. But the minute there's a hot deal and it starts getting away from them, they will chase. There's very few investors that can avoid that sort of seduction. And it's hard to manufacture it, but if you have a little bit of it, I think this book can help you amplify it and get the most out of it.
All right. If people want to check it out, it looks like is the same section that I've got here. I've got multiple sections. I think if they want it, they can go to the secret of
the secret of raisingmoney.com.
Thank you. The secret of raisingmoney.com. And if they do that, then they'll get these tactics. Thank you so much for doing this interview.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, guys.